Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
A disturbing study came out last fall. Death rates among white, middle-aged Americans have been rising steadily since 1999, due in large part to increases in the rates of suicide and drug abuse. Surely the reasons for these effects are numerous, but scholars who study the working class in America note that these workers are doing less well than their parents before them. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Beyond the stress of simply struggling to get by, my guest suggests members of America's white working class find that they have lost the narrative of their lives. They were raised to expect progress and instead find themselves falling behind. And maybe that lost narrative explains why there is so much anger among these Americans toward the government and toward neighbors of color who seem to be doing better than their parents. Sherry Lee Lincoln is director of Writing Curriculum Initiatives and professor of English at Georgetown University. She's scheduled to be the keynote speaker at Collin College's Texas Center for Working Class Studies conference on Thursday. Sherry, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on. It's lovely to be here.
Who are the working class in America?
It's such a great question because it's so hard to define. The working class gets defined in part by education. You know, it's very standard, for example, that pollsters talking about the election ask people whether or not they have a college education, and that's the basis. At the same time, we know that lots and lots of people identify themselves as working class even if they have a college education. In fact, a recent study showed that millennials are more likely to identify themselves as working class than their parents, even though they have higher rates of college education. We know that the working class is incredibly diverse, including everybody from white people who are commonly talked about as middle class, a lot of industrial workers, for example, to recent immigrants and people living in poverty. So it's incredibly hard to define. That said, things like the study that you mentioned that tracked white working class, white death rates, generally assume that the working class are people who are doing working class jobs. So people who work in service industries, people who work or used to work in manufacturing, and people who are really not winners in the economy. And that broad definition means that a whole lot of people can be assigned into the working class, even though we don't always use that term in American culture.
Are there particular values or experiences that you would say are characteristic of the working class and not the poor and not the middle class in America?
Sure. One is a value on working hard. One of the things that working class people have often said through much of history is that they pride themselves on getting up every day and going to work. More and more, that's getting up every day and going to two or three jobs in order to get by. But that notion of self-sufficiency, I think, is really important to the working class, even though working class culture often also includes a strong sense of commitment to the collective, a commitment to other people. There are a couple of scholars, Barbara Jensen and Jack Metzger, who have been trying to map the differences between middle class culture and working class culture. And one of the divides that they find is a difference between a goal of individual upward mobility and a goal of belonging, an idea on the middle class side that your purpose in life is to become something better than you are now, and a goal on the working class side, which is to be and to get as much out of your life as you can as it is. And part of that has to do with the nature of those jobs. People in middle class jobs often expect that they'll start in one level and they'll move up over the course of their lifetime, whereas people in working class jobs, often their primary hope is that they'll get to hold on to that job. So that, I think, is a really clear distinction. It's harder, I think, to make distinctions between the working class and people who are living in poverty, in part because so many people in the working class have spent part of their lives living in poverty. Most people in poverty end out actually moving up and down in terms of, you know, they move into jobs for a while and then lose them. There are people who once had jobs and lost them. And in many cases, and this is increasingly true, I think, in the United States right now, people who are living in poverty are actually people who are working, but who are not making enough to be able to afford stable living, keeping a car, feeding their family every day. So working and not working is actually not necessarily the divide.
You've noted, Sherry, that working class studies is an academic border region best studied across disciplines. What does that mean, and what areas of study are relevant?
And I should acknowledge that that's me writing for academics. So let me translate.
Thank you.
For the rest of the world. Basically, what it means is that if we want to understand working class people, working class lives, working class politics, we have to look at it from a variety of perspectives. We have to think about history. We have to think about the organization of society. We have to think about psychology. How do people think about themselves? We can look at the media and literature and art and see what kinds of stories are told in our world about what it means to be working class. But we can also, as, again, the study you cited earlier, we can look at things like medicine and look at patterns of life expectancy and the kinds of health problems people have. So in all of those different ways, you can gain understanding of the working class. Part of what we argue in working class studies is that those things shouldn't happen separately, but that we should be talking to each other. So as a scholar who studies primarily literature and media, among the most important conversations I have with my colleagues are with sociologists and historians, not necessarily with other literary scholars. So it's really just about getting us all talking together because we have so much to learn from each other.
You became interested in this approach in the mid-90s, inspired in part by the song Youngstown by Bruce Springsteen from the album The Ghost of Tom Joad. Before we talk about it, let's listen to a bit of that song.
Well, my daddy worked the furnace, kept him hotter than hell. I come home from now, I'm working my way to Scarford, a job that suits the devil as well. They'll attack and I cook in limestone, fed my children and made my pay. Them smokestacks reaching like the arms of God into a beautiful sky, soot and clay. Here in Youngstown, here in Youngstown, sweet Jenny, I'm
and there we have a very wealthy man singing an anthem yes. Really about the lives of the working class. The reference to Jenny may be different than people who didn't listen closely to the song might imagine.
Yes, Jenny is actually a blast furnace, not a woman. It sounds like it ought to be someone's lover. It was typical in steel towns that blast furnaces were named after the wives and daughters of the owners of the mills. The Jeanette blast furnace in Youngstown was the heart of the Briar Hill Works, which was part of U.S. Steel. And when that shut down, it became sort of a symbol for that town, along with a number of other mills that shut down, of what people were losing. Part of what I love about that song is that it reflects both the history and the pride that people felt in the work that they did building the steel that won this country's wars, the tanks and bombs that won this country's wars, and the sense of betrayal that they felt when those companies closed down. And in many cases, those companies closed even though they were making money. But they felt that they could make more money by moving somewhere else where they could pay workers less. And that left a whole lot of people out of work and continues to leave people out of work. Places like Youngstown lost those kinds of jobs in many cases in the 1970s and early 80s. And 40 years later, they are still trying to recover. And 40 years later, what was frustration, what was sadness, what was a sense of self-doubt, people turned it on themselves, is turning more and more into anger and sadly more and more into some self-destructive behaviors, which is part of what I think we see in the studies that show increasing death rates. A lot of that coming from addiction and suicide, and that ties directly to deindustrialization.
Anyone who's ever lost a job understands what a gut punch it can be, even if you don't have to worry about paying the bills, and most of us, of course, would if we were to lose our jobs. How does people's relationship to their communities change when communities that formed around a single employer no longer have that employer at the heart of them?
Two things happen at that point. One is that communities themselves begin to lose their identities. So a town like Youngstown or a place like Detroit that defined itself around an industry, when that industry contracts, people don't know how to think about their town. They don't know what to expect. And that means that one of the things that held them together, that gave them a sense of, again, pride, but also a sense of history and a sense of community, that is lost. But it's also true that people lose social networks. Part of what the workplace does for all of us, and I think this is true everywhere up and down the social class ladder, work is one of the places where we form our most important relationships and where we form so much of our sense of ourselves. So that in deindustrialization, people lost the quality of life in their communities, but they lost so much of a sense of themselves. I'm spending a lot of time these days reading literature that is about the children of the generation that was displaced in deindustrialization. And one of the things that's most striking in that is the ways they have inherited a sense of loss and a sense of self-doubt. So it really shifts the way people see themselves and how they fit into the world.
Even the idea of people in, you know, what were once really stable kind of lifetime jobs having to look for something new every few years. I was just walking down the hallway here at the station a few days ago and thinking about how much it functions like a neighborhood, right? There are, you know, really well the people on your block or in your department, but there are the people downstairs and we all come together for celebrations and to mourn losses. Those things are real effects.
That's true. And so that really does form people's connections and the relationships that shape their lives. You know, it's who you live with every day. And it's happening in all kinds of industries. It's interesting you talk about walking through the newsroom because journalism is one of the fields that has seen so much of this. You know, that we talk to journalists all the time. My husband and I, who edit the Working Class Studies blog, we end up talking to journalists regularly, and often we're talking to them about the fact that they can see the same kinds of patterns that happen in places like Youngstown or Detroit or Baltimore just by looking around their newsrooms. And I think that's probably true in lots of other kinds of workplaces, so that the experiences that the working class had 30 and 40 years ago as industry was contracting, more and more middle class people are having. And what that means is that the cultural difference between the working class and the middle class, I think, is beginning to be not quite erased, but smudged.
One of the things you looked at was the map of Youngstown. Where are commercial and residential properties occupied? Where are they vacant? What did that tell you about life within the community?
Well, what it told us is that lots and lots of people are living with the physical evidence of decline every day. So they look down the street, and where there used to be, you know, an aunt's house and the house where they played football when they were kids and the house of the woman who grew the great tomatoes in the neighborhood, so all of their memories, are now represented in many cases by either houses that are falling apart or empty lots. So that loss of social network that I'm talking about actually becomes a physical reality in people's lives. Living with all of that empty space, I think, is really hard for people. It shifts the way memory works. And if memory is part of how we form our identities, and I think it is, then when those physical places go away, we kind of fill in those spaces, but it's not the same. And it makes the sense of loss really, really just visceral because it's there every day in your face when you look out the window.
Sherry Lee Lincoln is Director of Writing Curriculum Initiatives and Professor of English at Georgetown University. She'll be the keynote speaker at Collin College's Texas Center for Working Class Studies Conference Thursday. We'll continue our conversation about the state of the American working class after this, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the Director of Writing Curriculum Initiatives and Professor of English at Georgetown University, Sherry Lee Lincoln. She'll be the keynote speaker Thursday at Collin College's Texas Center for Working Class Studies Conference. If you'd like to join our conversation about the state of the American working class, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Sherry, what can shrinking communities do to consolidate and preserve the parts of themselves that are still alive and functioning after the loss of a major industry or employer?
I wish I had the answer to that question. Many places. Again, Youngstown is a key, but we see it all across the country, are really struggling to figure out how to bounce back. And I think there are probably two or three things that help. One is what places like Youngstown did in the 1990s and the early 2000s, which was to accept the idea that they were never going to be the kind of city they once were. And it's a very hard thing for communities to do, not only emotionally, because we are Americans, after all, and we believe in progress and growth and things getting better, but also because it turns out that shrinking tactically is difficult. Youngstown in the 1990s passed a plan to try to do smart shrinkage. And part of the idea was that they would get people, on those blocks I was describing before where there were a bunch of empty lots and deteriorating houses, they would try to get people to move out of those neighborhoods so that they could stop providing city services to those neighborhoods. It turns out it's very hard to get people who, for the last 30 years, have invested a lot of time and energy in maintaining their property while their neighborhood is falling apart around them. It's very hard to get them to move. So the idea of shrinkage is difficult, but you kind of have to accept that things are not going to keep progressing and not keep growing and figure out what do we do with less. I think the other is to make use of history on some level, to tap into the culture that's there and to try to preserve it. And that doesn't necessarily mean kind of holding on nostalgically to how great things once were. Nostalgia gets a bad rap in that. But memory is valuable. And you have to help people recognize the good things about those communities so that they will want to continue to invest their time and energy in them. So part of that is about telling stories. Part of it is about understanding the history of the working class, including, by the way, helping people understand that the loss of industries in their towns, the economic struggles that they're facing, and this is true not only for industrial towns but all kinds of places, is probably not the fault of the majority of the people who live in the town. It's not that they're bad. It's not that they're failures. It's that they got caught in a large-scale economic change and a large-scale social change that they couldn't do anything about. So they need to not blame themselves. They need to not necessarily hold on to the injury of all of that, but they do need to be able to see how their history gave them a resource to build on. And then they have to think about what they might be able to do from here, and that's the hardest part. Because we live in many ways in a shrinking economy where there's not a lot of opportunity and where a lot of deindustrialized communities are competing with each other to get that warehouse or to get that call center. And many of the jobs that are coming in are not anywhere near as good as the jobs that were lost. People can get a kind of desperation to get any kind of work here that we can possibly get. It's a challenge to try to think about what else you can do, and there are not really good answers.
So a lot of people who have lost, factory jobs, mill jobs, have to end up in the service sector, which certainly can be honorable work, is challenging work. But a lot of those service sector jobs don't come with the kinds of, retirement benefits, pensions that sweeten the end of working class life. What are the consequences of that?
Well, first of all, I think we have to acknowledge that they come, most of them, with a lifetime of lower pay. So it's not only that you don't get the pension at the end, you don't have the opportunity during the course of your working lifetime to save up money. So it's part of what's contributing to, I think, a rise in poverty among older people. They just don't have the resources to take care of themselves. And lots of those people are getting older and older. As a nation, we're going to have to start dealing with, I think, growing poverty for an older generation and a younger generation that isn't necessarily seeing things being a lot better. So I think that long-term lack of income is really tough. A lot of those jobs don't come with good health care, and people continue to struggle even as we now have Obamacare. A lot of people continue to struggle with health care. Some people can't afford even the plans that are available. So that contributes to health problems. So we have a lot of people who are living in struggle all of their lives and then continuing to struggle even more as they go into retirement. It's part of what we're seeing in this year's election, I think, in the anger that people feel because they feel like they've been trying hard and they've been working hard, often at two or three jobs, to still make less than what they made or their father or their uncle or their mother made when the industrial jobs were still available. We're trying to adapt to that, but the fact is we're trying to adapt to something that is really not sustainable, and we're beginning to see the problems in things like addiction and suicide and death rates and illness and rising rates of poverty.
All right, so suicides and drug and alcohol-related deaths sound like really ominous signs of trouble for middle-aged white Americans. How are white working-class folks doing compared with their Black and Asian and Latino neighbors in similar jobs?
Well, there's two ways to think about that. In general, white working-class people almost always have higher rates of employment and higher incomes and higher wealth than their Black and Latino neighbors. That goes back to, and this is why I talk about the importance of interdisciplinarity, of looking at history. To understand that, you have to look at the history of the way they got into industrial work, that Black and Latino workers got those jobs much later and got union protections in those jobs much later. But what that means is that white families have built up more wealth. Wealth might sound like the wrong word, but you know, if you own a home, if you own a car, if you have any money in a savings account, they're likely to do better. On the other hand, one of the most interesting things out of the Case and Deaton study that showed the rising death rates is that those rates were rising for whites when they were not rising for African Americans. So it doesn't mean that there are not high rates among African Americans. And in fact, if we went back to the 1980s and 90s, we would have found more increases among African Americans. But in some ways, that level had stabilized over time, whereas the white level continued to grow. So it's an interesting kind of paradox, because I think I had always assumed that whatever it was for whites, it would always be worse for blacks. And it seems like things are equalizing just a little bit. I mean, there's all kinds of other aspects of race in this country that are not. But when it comes to some of those things, it does seem like things are beginning to become a little bit more alike.
So working class white families feel like they're losing ground, and families of color may feel like they're gaining ground?
I'm not sure that families of color necessarily feel like they're gaining ground. I think they might feel like they are holding steady.
Mm-hmm.
Things have not necessarily gotten significantly worse, though, you know, there are some recent reports and, you know, there's a recent book, for example, on eviction that talks about how, you know, for African-American men, the most common experience in contemporary America is going to prison. And for African-American women, the most common experience is being evicted. That goes back to that difference in wealth. So I don't want to suggest that there are not continuing issues. But I think part of why these most recent studies on death rates and drug abuse and suicide and all of those different really physical and mental health issues, part of why that got so much attention is that the rise was happening for whites when it was not happening for blacks.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have James on the line in Carrollton. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question I have is the globalization. Did that play a part in this, the globalization that has been going on the last 30 years and leads to, like, the class feeling that people feel like that the 1% are doing better than, like, the rest of it or things like that? Does that have a play in what you're talking about?
It's a great question, and the answer is absolutely yes. It's important to remember that deindustrialization in the United States often meant a growth in industry in other places. Over time, some of those places are now seeing their own deindustrialization as jobs are leaving China, believe it or not, to go to places where they can get workers for even less. So it's all connected. And I do think that part of what happened in the United States is that workers here saw what they saw as their jobs, you know, the jobs that we own, going to people who are not like them in other countries. And that fed a lot of resentment and a lot of anti-immigrant feeling. So I think it's part of what we see in the current political climate. It doesn't mean that those things are true only for the working class. It's not as if there was never any racism before that, and it's not as if only working class people ever look at the movement of jobs and feel angry and resentful. But it's all kind of connected. Increasingly, the economy functions on a global level, and the corporations that are making decisions are functioning on global levels. And there's all kinds of reasons why that happened. But I think it absolutely is feeding into the resentment that people feel.
It doesn't do people much good necessarily, but I remember being stunned a few years ago when someone pointed out that, in fact, the U.S. is still a leader in global manufacturing. It's just that a lot of that manufacturing is done by machines.
It's done by machines, and the jobs that are involved, there are fewer of them in part because of the machines, and the jobs aren't as good.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that has happened with the sort of classic industrial jobs, actually two things have happened. One is manufacturing has moved increasingly to the southern part of the United States where there are fewer unions. Unionized jobs generally have better pay and better benefits than non-union jobs. So people in the southern part of the United States gained jobs, but they're also getting paid less. They don't get as good of benefits. In many cases, they don't get as many hours, all kinds of things that make those not as good of jobs. In the places where there are still unions have agreed to contracts where newer workers get paid significantly less than the workers who had been there a long time. And there's a way of looking at that to say, well, the reason all of these factories had to close is that the workers were being greedy. They were asking for too much, and we see that in the wages that companies want to set. The problem is that those good wages were also wages that people could have a good life on. One of the reasons we get confused about class in this country is that for a long time, in the middle of the 20th century, working class people were making sufficient gains in industrial jobs that they could lead middle class lives. They could buy homes, they could buy a boat, they could take their family on vacation, they could send their children to college. All of that was made possible by unionized jobs. As contracts have been renegotiated and the value of those jobs in purely economic terms, the value of those jobs has gone down, the working class is struggling much more.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. Hi, Steve in Dallas. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hello. I'd like to connect the dots. I mean, we're beginning to connect the dots between the working class's desires, their frustrations, and the outlets that would satisfy those. So I'll say the policies. I think that this election cycle, we've had a real dearth of discussions around hard policies. It's been a lot of reflexive action around we need a revolution, or we need to go ahead and carpet bomb XYZ. But I'd like to know, what is it going to take to go ahead and understand the working classes, and for the middle classes, for that matter, frustrations and desires, and connect those to actual policies? I don't think that those desires are well understood at all. But having said that, how will we ever go ahead and get some policies in place that will assuage them?
Thanks for your call.
But that's a great question, because I think we are facing a kind of conflict. Part of it is that the kinds of policies that would give working class people, again, I'll define that as people who are doing working class kinds of jobs, hourly paid jobs, industrial work, service work, those kinds of things. If we want those workers to have better lives, we need to do at least two things. We need to pay them more, and we need to provide them with better health care, with better benefits. That probably also includes better pensions and that kind of thing. But we've had a move away from those kinds of things. There are discussions going on in the U.S. right now about raising the minimum wage, and there's some pushback on that. I think a lot of the challenge is we're really debating what would be the policies that would help the working class and really increasingly would help the middle class. We are almost 40 years into the gospel of trickle-down economics that says if we make it possible for the people who own and run companies to make more money, the wealth that they make will trickle down by creating more jobs for more people. And what we lost in that equation is, first, not only that that doesn't necessarily happen, but that more jobs doesn't necessarily mean more good jobs. So we have some growth in jobs. Most of the kinds of jobs that are growing in this country are low-wage jobs that don't require a college education, that are, in many cases, part-time jobs, don't come in with any kind of pension, don't come with any kind of benefits. Those are the jobs that are growing. What we need to do, I think, is change the equation for those jobs. Is that realistic? I'm skeptical. I think that politics in this country right now is really built around the idea that what we have to do is defend the interests of the companies, and the faith is that that will generate better outcomes for workers. But it's just not happening. And that, I think, requires a bigger change in how we approach policy.
Sherry Lee Lincoln is my guest. She's director of Writing Curriculum Initiatives and professor of English at Georgetown University. She'll be the keynote speaker Thursday at Collin College's Texas Center for Working Class Studies Conference. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Sherry Lee Lincoln, professor of English at Georgetown University and keynote speaker at Collin College's Texas Center for Working Class Studies Conference Thursday. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think or call 1-800-933-5372. Sherry, are working class people in America participating in their communities in fundamentally the same ways they were a few decades ago, still going to church and signing up for softball leagues and showing up at PTA meetings?
Well, many of them are. I think those kinds of things have replaced in some ways the shop floor as the places where people come together. At the same time, the population that engages in those kinds of activities is aging. And there's a younger generation coming up that participates in community life, but it looks a bit different from that. So if we measure community life by church going or PTA meetings, we're missing part of what's happening with younger working class people. I have a colleague in Youngstown named Hannah Woodruff, who's an anthropologist who is studying a kind of alternative version of working class culture there, where she's finding a lot of younger people who are sort of opting out of the standard institutions. And instead of going to church, they are volunteering at the local community garden, and they are engaging in a barter economy, and they're working multiple part-time jobs, but they're also making art and being part of artists' collectives in various places. And they really are, I think they represent an interesting shift in working class culture that is in many ways away from work, so that work becomes much less a definition of the heart of people's lives. But so does consumption. It's an almost anti-capitalist version of working class life, in the sense that people are much less concerned about, am I going to have steady work? Am I going to be able to afford a home? Can I buy a new car? And much more concerned about, what's the quality of my life? Can I do the kinds of things I care about? Can I be connected with people in sort of more day-to-day, ordinary ways, rather than in the institutions that were once at the heart of working class and really many middle class communities?
Is there a difference between, a difference that you can articulate between working class folks who are frustrated and really concerned, who gravitate toward what some would call the sort of, you know, the vent for their anger that is expressed by Bernie Sanders, as opposed to the vent for their anger that is expressed by a candidate like Donald Trump?
I think so. I think part of the distinction has to do with where their resentment is targeted. So I think there's a lot of resentment among the working class, white as well as people of color, but certainly in this election, as in many elections, we end up paying most attention to white working class voters because class seems to play a larger role in their votes. What we're seeing is that the Trump voters are, the Trump supporters, I think are really responsive to an anger that is directed not only at some of the financial institutions and not only at government, but also at immigrants, at people of color, at the idea of political correctness. They are feeling that they've been repressed and brushed aside for a very long time. I think a lot of the Sanders supporters are, first of all, they have a greater sense of faith that government can actually do something. And in many cases, they are more interested in how the system works. So they're more angry at Wall Street. They share a concern about trade. They share a concern about government having been taken over by the wrong kinds of interests. But they're a little bit more, I guess I would say, hopeful about the potential for government to come in. It's interesting, I think, to see that division. One of the things that we've talked about quite a lot on the Working Class Perspectives blog is the question of whether those two groups of voters, how far apart they are. So my colleague John Russo, who wrote a great piece on Trump and Sanders and the precariat, talks always about the parabola of politics. And he argues that the people on the two ends of the spectrum, those are not far away from each other, but it's like a big loop. And they actually, in some ways, are very close to each other. We see that, I think, in some of the people who've been interviewed in coverage of this campaign, who say things like, if Bernie Sanders is not the candidate for the Democrats, I will vote for Donald Trump. That they see in both of them a rejection of institutions as they've functioned and an anger that is really trying to change the system in ways that might help them.
You've been dismayed to find some cultural critics assigning blame for the decline in the standard of living of working class Americans to a decline in morals among the working class.
Yes, and we see that a lot. My colleague Jack Metzger has written several pieces looking at the various books that have come out. So Charles Murray, Robert Putnam, Andrew Chernin, there's a number of them that have come out in the last few years that talk about the decline in working class culture and really talk about, you know, the question you were asking a few minutes ago about people not participating in their communities, about high levels of children born out of wedlock, about decreasing levels of marriage. And there are some critics who have looked at that and said, well, that reflects a moral decline in the working class. There are many of us who look at that and say that reflects an accommodation to the economic decline of the working class. So marriage rates are a good example. Part of what you need in order to get married is the money to set up a household and a belief in the long-term stability of relationships. You need to think that those kinds of institutions are going to work. The experiences of working-class people in the last 30 years suggest that it's much harder for them to believe in those things. It's not necessarily a moral decline, and I'm always worried. I say this about a moral decline. I say it when commentators assign to the white working class all of the racism in American culture, because in neither case is it just the working class who is experiencing those things. And in many cases, I think we need to put that into the context of the kinds of economic declines that we've been talking about and the kinds of frustrations that people have experienced.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Mike on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call. And what a very nice discussion. And especially I found interesting that the question that you posed about what your guest thinks, why the gap is narrow, whether the blacks have now finally caught up with the white standard of living or something like that. And actually, the guest has answered it, but also I have my additional comments. Actually, what happened is just because now the politicians are, you know, pandering for the votes, and they brought the problem onto the surface because now their problem, you know, they're talking about, drugs, how they're killing, you know, the white male, you know, like middle-aged white men and whatnot. You know, and just as if like now it's like almost like at an alarming rate, you know, white middle-aged men are dying. As if, you know, actually for decades, you know, actually younger African-Americans were dying a whole lot more. But they were using the rhetoric, you know, harshly, like when they say, for example, they wanted to, you know, test for drugs to, you know, to qualify for welfare benefits and stuff. That used to be like a code word. But now they're just trying to appeal to the white electorate. Now, all of a sudden, now this drug problem and stuff has become like, you know, just the way it should be.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Mike. What do you think about that, Sherry? Are we sort of pathologizing the problems of middle class, working class white Americans, whereas when problems of a similar nature existed among Americans of color, that we sort of call that a character flaw?
Yeah, I think that is definitely true. Certainly we can look back 10 or 20 years ago and the statistics for African Americans in terms of drug addiction and death rates were probably very similar and rising in ways that we now are seeing with whites. But it is historically true over and over again that when social problems begin to surface among the majority, among the mainstream, then people notice them. So, you know, we have said for many years out of working class studies that when middle class people started losing their jobs regularly, now we wanted to pay attention to what happened when people lost their jobs. And I think the same is happening now, that when these things are happening to whites, they become more a matter of concern because white working class people are not the people to whom this is supposed to happen. And so it stands out, whereas in some ways, sadly and inaccurately, we expect that kind of thing from African Americans.
I would imagine that hope is a difficult thing to quantify. And yet, that's a lot of what you're writing about here, the hope that things will turn out okay, or the loss of that hope. You call it a loss of narrative. Can you talk a little bit about how that relates to the work that you're doing and how you measure it among a particular population?
I think it's very hard to measure. And I think the only way we get to it really is by talking to people, by listening to their stories, by trying to find where they are finding hope, where they are finding persistence. I think the most incredible thing is that in places, and I talk about Youngstown a lot because I was there, as the co-director of the Center for Working Class Studies there for many years, and so that's kind of my home base for this. But you would find it not only across the Rust Belt, but I think through much of the United States. People have survived. They have kept going. They've found ways to take care of their families. They've found a way to patch together a living. And there is pride in that, and there should be pride in that, even though it doesn't match the standard narrative of what American life is supposed to be, and even though it doesn't seem to promise much in terms of upward mobility. But I think people find hope in that sense of persistence, in their sense that, you know, we are keeping going, and we're going to keep hoping that somehow things are going to get better for our kids, that somehow we're all going to come together and fight for something that can change. And that's a really hard thing to do anymore. I mean, the unions have been under attack, but any kind of community organizing rests on hope, and it requires a lot of work. And there are a lot of people doing that work. I think the most exciting thing I see as I look out at working class communities is that there are people coming together. And sometimes there are people coming together after many years of struggle who are turning their frustration not to anger at anybody else, but at getting together with their neighbors and saying, we have to be the ones who are going to take care of these problems. We have to take care of each other. We have to change our communities. We have to change the narrative of our lives in a better way.
To the extent that working class people feel betrayed but can't articulate exactly why, does it matter whether their frustration lies mostly with, you know, the folks who beat them out for jobs, either here or abroad, or with government or with corporations? Does that matter in terms of how they reshape a narrative of their lives that works for them?
You know, that's a great question. I think it has to matter, because I think you have to be able to read the landscape of that, to sound like an academic, as accurately as possible. And I think one of the problems is not only when people, you know, turn it to the others who they think have stolen their jobs or taken their opportunity or are getting benefits that they're not getting, or to people who they think silenced them, made it impossible for them to talk about things out of political correctness, or to blaming themselves for somehow not being good enough and not trying hard enough. Any of the ways that we do that are only partial slices of what's going on. I think one of our hopes in working class studies is that by looking at all of this, by talking with working class people as we look at all of this, so that they're part of our conversations, it isn't just a bunch of academics off in a corner, it's people working in communities, that by doing all of that, we can help people see the full range of the causes of what's going on, and that might be able to, might help them be better able to respond.
Sherry Lee Lincoln is Director of Writing Curriculum Initiatives and Professor of English at Georgetown University. She will be the keynote speaker at Collin College's Texas Center for Working Class Studies Conference Thursday. Sherry, it's been a very interesting conversation. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you for having me on. It's been great to talk with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.